Minnesota to Florida, Nebraska to Ohio, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, Democrats are trying to expand the number of justices on the Supreme Court of the United States. Dr. John Sparks from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College is here to explain why that threatens the court's independence. As the 2022 midterm elections begin to take shape, Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story on the races that will decide control of the U.S. Senate. Democrats are queuing up a massive tax cut for the wealthiest Americans. For the wealthy, you say? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine is here to explain. And Kansas has enacted what could become the gold standard for property tax reform at the state level. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Packing and making structural changes to the Supreme Court of the United States is a top goal of the American left. Dr. John Sparks is a research fellow at the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania. He is here to talk about the impact of such changes. John, welcome to American Radio Journal. John, when we hear talk of expanding the size of the Supreme Court of the United States, of packing the court, is this something that Congress can do, or does this have to be done by a constitutional amendment?
Well, Loman, just adding someone to the court, increasing the size, is something that the Constitution allows the Congress to do. So the answer is yes, they can do that. However, and they've only done it several times and mostly in the remote past, so it's been 152 years since 1869 that the courts remained at nine justices.
There has also been some talk. The president, of course, has a, quote, commission to look at this, and whether commissions ever lead to any actual action is debatable, but they're talking about perhaps changing the structure, maybe changing the length of terms, how the justices are selected. That something, however, would require a constitutional amendment?
Yes, the Constitution is very sparse when it comes to details in the Supreme Court. It shall be one Supreme Court. However, the justices serve for life. So, for example, proposal that has been made that they serve only a fixed term of, I think the proposal that's been batted around now is 18 years. That would require a constitutional amendment. Just increasing the size, Congress could do, but actually changing the structure in the sense of a fixed term at which time the justices would be asked to step down, that would require a constitutional amendment.
Now, John, the manner in which the Supreme Court justices are selected, the length of term, lifetime appointment, et cetera, very different than the other two branches of government. What was the thinking of the founders or the framers of the Constitution in setting up a branch of government that is so very different?
The founders wanted what was called at that time a mixed government, meaning there were different, there were various forms of government that they drew on from the past. Some features of the Constitution, the House, for example, is a more democratic kind of institution. But then the Senate, for example, is not really democratic. The founders gave equal power to the states regardless of population size. So California has two senators with all its population, and the citizens of Montana have two as well. And the president has a kind of monarchical power, almost a king-like power to veto. He's elected by the Electoral College, not by direct popular vote. The Supreme Court, people do not, the people directly do not choose members of that court, and they have to go through the Senate to be confirmed. So the whole Constitution is not a solely democratic in the sense of direct people activity in every phase. And that, I think that that was wisdom on the part of the founders, because they were fearful that in some cases majorities could become tyrannical.
And in the current instance, we have a very closely divided Congress, 50-50 in the United States Senate. In the United States House of Representatives, Democrats have, depending on the number of vacancies at any given point in time, maybe 5, 6, 7 seat majority. There is a move to expand the number of justices on the court. What is the rationale behind wanting to do that at this particular point in time?
Well, it seems to me the least convincing one comes from the dean of the University of California, Berkeley Law School, Erwin Chemerinsky, who says that he just doesn't want a conservative court over the next 10 or 20 years. Now, that's not really a concern about the long-range structure of the court. It's just trying to get four new justices to be appointed by President Biden. And that would turn, unfortunately, the court into a truly political football. Once the Republicans gained the slightest edge in Congress and elected a Republican president, then they would probably think about expanding the court further. And pretty soon, the court would be, its holdings would only be as valid as the latest election cycle.
There also has been an argument advanced, John, that every president ought to have the opportunity to appoint at least one justice of the Supreme Court. And of course, justices are serving longer to older ages because, fortunately, the entire population lives longer. Is there really a problem in terms of each president being given the opportunity to put his or her, in the future, perhaps her, stamp on the court?
No, there's no problem with that. If you look at the history of appointments, interestingly, you'll find out that every full-term president, so that leaves out like somebody like Garfield, who only served a few months, every full-term president, with the exception of Jimmy Carter, has had a chance to appoint at least one justice. And if you average out the appointments, they come out to something like, over the 46 presidents, something like 2.6 appointments per president. So I really don't think there's a problem with that. There was a lull during the George Bush administration in which some of the commentators thought that it had gone 10 or 11 years without an appointment. But he appointed two, and he kept close to the national average, so to speak, for presidents. So presidents do have usually an opportunity. And in the case of President Trump, he was able to appoint three, but that was really unusual because of the configuration of two deaths plus a resignation in his term.
We have been talking with John Sparks, who is a fellow at the Institute for Faith and Freedom, that, of course, based at Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania. John, tell us a bit about the Institute for Faith and Freedom, and also give us a website where folks can go to read more of your writing.
That institute is devoted to those two important traditional ideas, freedom, the freedom of the individual protected by a series of rights in the Constitution, and to faith, traditional Christian faith. You can read various contributors by going to faithandfreedom.com, and there you'll see the postings of a number of scholars, including Paul Ken Gore and myself.
John Sparks from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College. John, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Lewin.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth keeps an eye on all of the developing races for U.S. Senate and U.S. House of Representatives seats around the country. Today we're going to focus on Senate races. Scott, good to have you here.
Always great to be with you, Lohman. Thanks for having me back again.
Scott, we are tied, literally, at 50-50, 50 Republicans in the U.S. Senate and 48 Democrats and two independents who caucus with the Democrats. So you can't get any more, evenly tied here. Looking ahead, what is the overall landscape in terms of open seats and competitive races as we head into the 2022 election cycle?
Well, obviously, we're still waiting on some decisions from key senators on whether or not they're going to run for re-election. But what we do know right now is there's a number of highly competitive and very, very expensive Senate races that are in play for the 2022 elections. Club for Growth PAC has already made two major endorsements within the state of Ohio and the state of North Carolina. In Ohio, we previously endorsed Josh Mandel in his race in an open Senate race That's a competitive Republican primary. He'll be facing some self-funders like Jane Timken and Bernie Marino. There's also a guy named Mike Gibbons, who's more of a Liberty candidate and has some money, and he's run for office before. So there's a lot of experience in that race. Josh is by far the front runner as it stands right now, given his high name ID. He's a previous Secretary of State, and he's also run for the United States Senate twice before. He lost, I think, in the 2012 election to Sherrod Brown, and then in 2018 when he was going to give it another shot, he ended up withdrawing from the race after some personal issues with his family. So he withdrew, but he's back at it again. We're really excited to be supporting him, and this is one of the best opportunities that we believe we've got to get a real fighter for a conservative economic agenda into the United States Senate. Then going back down to North Carolina, we've got Congressman Ted Budd, who's from the 13th Congressional District in North Carolina. Congressman Budd is a fantastic ally of the Club for Growth. We're fully behind his candidacy. He's running against another former representative, Mark Walker, and the former governor of North Carolina, Pat McCrory. McCrory should be viewed as a front runner given his own experience running three times statewide, but he's obviously lost two times in those races. And we feel good about the chance that Ted Budd has in order to win that race. Then if you look at the other big Senate races that are open and that we're closely following, trying to figure out if there's the right candidate for our political action committee to endorse, I would start off with your home state of Pennsylvania. Sean Parnell has recently announced that he's running for the United States Senate. There's another candidate named Jeff Bartos. And then there's a bunch of other folks that are still considering whether they're going to run or not. You also have a former ambassador, Carla Sands. And, you know, I think that that's just going to be a big-time race that we're going to be watching to see who the viable candidates are and how they can really move forward with an agenda and message that captures the imagination of those voters in Pennsylvania. Moving along, we also have open races within the state of Missouri following the retirement of Roy Blunt. We also have an open race in the state of Alabama following the retirement of Richard Shelby. We have competitive races in Georgia against Raphael Warnock, in Arizona against Senator Kelly, and also in Nevada against Cortez Masto. There is still some time for credible candidates to emerge in those competitive races. But obviously a Senate race is a little bit different than a House race because you have to run close to a two-year campaign to raise the amount of money that's necessary today in politics to be a competitive, star-studded candidate that can raise enough money to get their message out, build their name ID, and go up against these entrenched incumbents. So those are some of the bigger races. We're still waiting on decisions for whether or not Chuck Grassley in Iowa is going to run for re-election, whether or not Ron Johnson in Wisconsin is going to run for re-election. Those are a couple of outstanding senators overall, and whether or not they decide to hang it up or to give it another go, that's up to them, but we expect to hear decisions from them in the next few months.
Are we looking at any potential primary challenges to incumbent U.S. Senator Scott?
The ability to knock off a United States senator in a primary challenge is difficult. But one of the other incumbents that the Club for Growth has gotten behind is Mike Lee from Utah. Mike Lee actually is facing a few Romney-type Republicans that are interested in running for the United States Senate against him. Senator Lee is the highest-rated United States senator on the Club for Growth Foundation economic scorecard, and we are 100% behind his election. So, you know, I would tell anybody thinking about primarying Mike Lee, good luck, because he's got a lot of big-time allies when it comes to the political action committees like the Club for Growth and Senate Conservatives Fund and Freedom Works and groups like that.
You did mention the states of Arizona and Georgia, where there are likely going to be competitive races. Those seats were just elected here last year. Why are they up already?
In Arizona in 2020, that was just a two-year term to fill out the remainder from after John McCain's death. And so when you've got a special election basically for the Senate, it's not a brand new six-year term. They keep those elections on track for every 6 years. So if somebody died in their fifth year, then the appointment from the governor would fill out the rest of the term, and then they run again in a brand new election to fill the remaining 6 years. In this instance, There was the appointment of Martha McSally. She got 2 years out of it. Then you had the special election, filled out the remainder of John McCain's term, and then now it goes back to the normal cycle of a six-year election. And it's the same thing for that big Georgia race. That's why Raphael Warnock is already up for re-election, even though he just won his race in the Georgia runoff in January.
Scott, we always like to end our program with you telling us a little bit about the club.
So the Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C., our nation's capital. We're a group united in this idea of economic freedom and economic liberty. And if anybody wants to check us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org, and you can see us on Twitter at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, as always, we appreciate your being here. Take care.
All right. Thank you, Loman.
A proposed lifting of the cap on the state and local tax deduction would, in fact, be a massive tax cut for the wealthiest Americans. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine has details.
Last July, while the country was battling the deadly pandemic and the economy was still staggering from a combination of high unemployment, government-imposed lockdowns, and rising levels of debt, then Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer outlined his biggest priorities for Democrats in the event that they were able to take control of Congress in November, which, of course, they did. And right at the top of the list was cutting taxes for the wealthiest Americans in high-tax states like his own home of New York. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, we're taking a close look at this political conundrum that the Democrats find themselves in as they try to repeal the so-called SALT cap. That's the cap on the state and local income tax deduction, a cap that was implemented in 2017 as part of the Trump-era tax reforms, but one that Democrats have really wanted to get rid of ever since it was passed, and one that they may soon have the opportunity to repeal. The conundrum is that the state and local tax deduction overwhelmingly benefits the wealthiest Americans, and specifically wealthy Americans who live in high-tax states like New York and California. That's quite a bit at odds with the message that Democrats like to send about being the party of the working class and about wanting to tax the rich to pay for all manner of new government programs. And threading that needle is going to be pretty difficult for the party. Now, going back to what Schumer said in July of last year at a press conference in Long Island, he said, "I want to tell you this. If I become majority leader, one of the first things I will do is eliminate it forever. It will be dead, gone, and buried." The "it" that he's talking about there was this cap on the state and local tax deduction, which, as I said, was imposed in 2017 as part of the federal tax reform bill that Republicans passed and President Donald Trump signed. As a result of that law, Americans are now allowed to deduct a maximum of $10,000 in state and local tax payments from their federally taxable income. Previously, that deduction had been uncapped, and it overwhelmingly benefited the richest households while shifting their federal tax burden to everyone else. Unsurprisingly, that's why repealing the cap has become a major priority for Schumer and Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, who, of course, hails from California. Their constituents, people living in expensive parts of high-tax states, stand to benefit more than just about any other Americans from the repeal of the SALT cap. Now, Democratic support for repealing the SALT cap could complicate passage of President Joe Biden's $2 trillion infrastructure plan, because some members of Congress, and to be fair, this includes a few Republicans as well, but it's mostly Democrats, have vowed not to vote for the infrastructure bill unless it includes a provision that repeals the SALT cap. Now, that provision, that part of it, is not part of the plan that President Joe Biden has proposed, but once it gets in front of Congress, of course, they can make whatever changes they want. So it turns out that special tax breaks for the wealthy might count as infrastructure, too. Who could have seen that coming? Now, Senator Bernie Sanders is correct to point out, as he did in an interview with Axios this week, that the SALT cap creates a real serious optics problem for Democrats. Sanders said that he would oppose Schumer's effort to attach the SALT cap repeal to the transportation bill because it just sends a terrible, terrible message, Sanders said, when you have Republicans telling us that this is a tax break for the rich. Now, Sanders is trying to turn this into a Democrat-Republican thing, but let's be clear, it's not just Republicans saying that. The Brookings Institution far from a right-wing nonprofit, calculated last year that 96% of the benefits from the SALT cap repeal would go to the top 20% of earners, and the top 1% of earners would get 57% of the benefits. In fact, in an op-ed for the New York Times, a pair of Brookings researchers wrote that in isolation, the change, the SALT cap repeal, would be more skewed to the rich than the 2017 tax reform bill that Democrats have spent years decrying as an unfair giveaway to the wealthiest Americans. And again, this is the Brookings Institution and the New York Times. These aren't Republicans saying this. These are centrist, even liberal organizations and media outlets saying this. Spending enough money on campaign ads, of course, can fix any sort of political messaging problems that parties might have, but the SALT cap debate also presents a major policy problem for Democrats that's likely to be more difficult to solve. At its core, Biden's policy agenda, what we've been able to discern from the first 100 days or so of his administration, amounts to a promise that the government will take on a larger role in paying for just about every aspect of ordinary Americans' lives. Everything from child care for the young to in-home assistance for the elderly will be covered by the government via expanded tax credits, direct subsidies, and a bigger role for Medicare and Medicaid. All of this, as Biden explained last week in his joint address to Congress, will be financed by higher taxes on the rich. In that joint address to Congress, he said that we can do it without increasing deficits. Instead, the rich will just be expected to pay more. Specifically, Biden has proposed raising the top income tax rate to 39%, 39.6% actually, from the 37% level where it currently sits. He also wants to hike taxes on capital gains, which, of course, more wealthy people tend to have, so that they are taxed more like ordinary income. But regardless of whether Biden's scheme to hike taxes and grow government has merit on its own, this means that the Democratic support for repealing the SALT cap isn't just an intellectual inconsistency or an awkward political messaging problem. It's a fundamental misalignment of the basics of the party's agenda. A more expensive government that provides more benefits to more people, the Democratic argument goes, must be financed by those who can most afford to pay. But I guess only after we hand them a giant tax cut first? Repealing the SALT cap would add roughly $500 billion to the deficit, too, so whose taxes do Democrats propose to increase to close that gap? In short, Democrats can be the party that demands wealthy Americans pay higher taxes, or they can be the party that favors repealing the state and local income tax deduction cap. Trying to be both requires more than just mental gymnastics. It probably means sacrificing a significant portion of Biden's agenda just to pay off political donors in high-tax states like New York and California. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out more of our coverage of the Biden administration and everything else going on in D.C. and around the country this week at Reason.com. And catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Property taxes are among the most hated of taxes. But Kansas recently took some significant steps toward reform. For details, we turn to Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council for this American Radio Journal commentary.
Property taxes are generally the most hated of all taxes, and for very good reason. As they pay their property tax bills each year, owners are forced to cut a check and realize the real cost of government. From the small business owner who is struggling to make payroll to the millennial attempting to make their first home purchase, high property tax burdens affect all of us. In some cases, retirees on fixed incomes can tragically be taxed out of their homes as property tax bills steadily increase. Addressing the issue of excessive property tax burdens can be an extremely challenging endeavor at the state level for policymakers, since most real property taxes are levied at the local levels of government, and thus based on the spending level set by those local governments. However, in our view, state lawmakers in Topeka, Kansas, have just perfected the recipe for states across America to address this property tax problem. After passing in the Kansas House and Senate by overwhelming and bipartisan margins, Democrat Governor Laura Kelly recently signed what they called the Truth in Taxation Property Tax Reform. The new Kansas Truth in Taxation law reduces the mill levy so the new property valuations produce the same dollar amount of property tax to cities, counties, and school districts as it did in the previous year. If local officials want to raise their revenue-neutral mill levy, they must just notify their citizens of the intent, hold a public hearing and take comment, and then, and this is essential, take a recorded vote on the entire tax increase. These new requirements thereby close the honesty gap. Local officials can no longer pretend to, quote-unquote, hold the line on property tax rates while taking in large increases from valuation changes in property values. This common sense policy is based on the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, model policy and the success in places like Utah. Under Utah's Truth in Taxation Law, which has been on the books since 1985, the effective property tax rate has declined by 7.5% between just the years 2000 and 2018. During that same period, for instance, Kansas's effective tax rate jumped by 22%. Because of their new successful Truth in Taxation reforms, hardworking taxpayers in Kansas can expect lower effective property tax rates and a much more honest discussion around the property tax burdens in the future. State-level policymakers are frequently reminded, and for good reason, by their constituents of the painful symptom of high property tax burdens. But they often, unfortunately, misdiagnose the underlying cause, which of course is spending growth by cities and counties. And due to decades of unintended consequences, many states that originally adopted personal income taxes did so to buy down local property tax burdens with state revenue. The status quo is indeed a great political deal for progressive local units of government when you think about it. Spend liberally, and then when the bills come due, send a portion of it to state capital, along with your taxpayer-funded lobbyists in many cases, and then ask for the additional revenue from state-level elected officials. When those localities with the tax and spend behaviors do not receive the state aid they receive from the state level, they can conveniently then direct the anger from their property taxpayers towards the state capital. Considering principled and long-term strategies for reducing high property tax burdens is essential. When policy changes are implemented successfully, states can dramatically improve their economic competitiveness, as well as remove a crushing burden from individual and business property owners who are concerned with the escalation in their property tax bills. When the Truth in Taxation Law was passed, for instance, Utah had the 24th lowest property taxes in the country. But thanks in part to this reform, Utah has improved to the 14th lowest tax burden today. This has been one of the policy reforms that has kept Utah as the top economic outlook in America now for all 14 editions of our annual Rich States, Poor States, Alec Laffer State Economic Competitiveness Index. Other states are likely to follow suit as they realize the incredible benefits of having a more predictable and transparent property tax system that enhances economic competitiveness and empowers property tax owners to take action. More states should follow the lead of Kansas and Utah so they can avoid the fate of New Jersey and other high-tax states. For more information on how to address out-of-control property tax burdens in your state, go to alec.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thank you for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WPPI-FM in Topsham, Maine, WPEI-FM in Saco, Maine, along with WKSP-FM in Augusta, Georgia. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.